Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how experiencing financial stress may lead to physical pain. University of Virginia has an interesting study on that. And also, the omega-3 fatty acids are extremely important, but what they can do is they can help decrease breast density in obese women. That's important because that can help prevent breast cancer. Also, too much salt could potentially contribute to liver damage. How can we cut back on salt, especially if we like salty taste? In obese patients, 5% weight loss has significant health benefits. Washington University School of Medicine. And also probiotics for depression. Medscape Psychiatry is talking about that and much more on health and healing. Then we're going to look at a lot of environmental issues today, including climate's disruption, a new record. Carbon dioxide levels have reached the highest point in 15 million years. What does that mean? Why should we care? Well, we should care. And I'll explain about how that heat is going to cause more people to die in ways that you can't imagine. I'll explore that. Also today, we're going to look at half the elderly in the United States who have colorectal cancer are receiving, quote, valueless treatment. Who says valueless treatment? University of Colorado, the Ann Schultz Medical Campus, published in the journal Medical Care. What does that mean? It means an awful lot of older people who have colorectal cancer are knowingly given treatments that will not benefit them. Well, then why do it? Could it be $2.2 billion annually just off that treatment? Well, surely it must give them an extended life. Not so much. Also, we're going to examine pharmaceutical companies and how they cause doctors to receive very biased information about drugs, and that in itself is causing hundreds of thousands of lives a year. That's according to a study published in The Independent. We're also going to have a guest in the second part of our program today. We're going to talk about runaway inequality. We're going to take a deeper look at its long-term consequences in the relationship to health, war, and climate change. Les Leopold. He is the co-founder and executive director of the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute. He also created the Blue-Green Alliance, and he helps organize the merger between labor unions with environmental concerns like the Sierra Club. So we're going to have an interesting conversation. Additionally, if time permits, how forests loss is leading to the rise of human disease. Jim Robbins on that one. And I want to give you a brief glimpse of both George Bush Sr. and Ronald Reagan giving their input on immigration. But then I'm going to open that up for you to be able to give us your point of view. What do you believe should be done to have a more humane way of dealing with the immigrants and looking at all the different possibilities of how we could bring the immigrants into the United States in a way that does away with ICE, does away with the idea that they're being exploited so they wouldn't be exploited. That's something Sears or Chavez did with the farm workers for a long time because they were given no portisans, they were given terrible working conditions, and they were susceptible to a lot more miscarriages and diseases because of pesticides. So what is the solution? I'd like to hear your feedback. Also from Robert Reich on power. Who has it and how to take it back? Because what is it that we do when we elect someone? We give them our power to make choices over us. Also a Disney IT worker who was laid off. He was replaced by something I've been warning you about. I've told you about this. The H-1B workers. Now, hundreds of his colleagues also were laid off. This was a Senate panel hearing, And how many of these highly educated, very disciplined workers coming in from South Korea and India and other countries, how many of them have come in and taken American jobs? 8 million. 8 million. Not a word about this. Why? Could it be that, well, let's say that you've worked for a company for 25 years, you're making $150,000, $200,000 a year plus benefits, you got a month's vacation, and now you're told, we just hired this person, they're going to take your place, you can train them for another 3 months, we're paying them $40,000, no benefits, no vacation, no overtime. That's happening. So first it was the poorest who were laid off, and then it was the non-essentials. Now it's the essentials being replaced, and in this way, it is a very important factor. So those who thought that, well, they were not going to be laid off because, don't count on it. So you see, we have a lot to cover, and we always try to cover the issues that the listeners say are important to them. We do pay careful attention to all of you, and with the millions that are coming in every week, we thank you, and we will do the kind of programming that you want. Let's do this in reverse. I talked about probiotics and depression. A few weeks ago, the first video in a series by Dr. Drew Ramsey drew out on the Medscape Psychiatry, discussing some of the highlights of brain food and then the microbiome. And we think of the microbiome as the medium in the intestine. Well, what does that have to do with your brain? Well, here's the takeaway, and this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrition, that when you have healthy intestine, when you're eating healthy foods, and this was, by the way, was a double-blind randomized placebo-controlled trial, you end up better feeding your brain. They're interconnected. Good bacteria in the intestine, which are the probiotics, sets up a good medium, and that means that you have more biomarkers for inflammation, so therefore you're able to overcome inflammation, and depression ends up creating inflammation. So by helping you have good, healthy, anti-inflammatory microbes in your intestine, in your gut, you're actually helping overcome depression because of the pathways of anti-inflammatory pathways that they share. So good gut in the bacteria, healthier brain. That is the takeaway message, and that's important. Also, there's a way of reversing disease with very successful therapies to eliminate life-threatening cancers and even terminal liver disease. And not a whole lot of people outside the medical community are aware of a simple nutrient. Now, I don't believe in standalone cure-all nutrients. I believe there are some nutrients that are extraordinarily beneficial, and that has been proven. For example, curcumin. There's over 8,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature showing how powerful it is. And vitamin C. There's over 50,000 studies on vitamin C. But one that rarely gets attention but deserves it is alpha lipoic acid. Alpha, A-L-P-H-A, lipoic, L-I-P-O-I-C, acid. It has been proven as a rejuvenating factor for the liver, plus eliminating some of the deadliest of cancers, including cancer cells found in the liver and pancreas. Now, I'm not talking about curing. What I'm talking about is substantially putting the weight of your immune system on your side to go against these cancers. There was good studies done by Dr. Bert Burskin, MD, PhD, who has been successful in treating patients with terminal cancers for a long time, and alpha-lipoic acid was a centerpiece of that overall program, especially restoring healthy liver function and ridding the body of other illnesses. Of the recently passed Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, who I knew very well, he was what I would call a professional friend. Didn't hang out together, weren't close buddies, but dozens and dozens of times we would get together and talk about healing modalities, cancer, the immune system. After all, he studied immunology at Sloan Kettering under Dr. Good, who was the father of immunology at Sloan Kettering. And that inspired him into building up the immune system. Now, it was Nicholas's belief that he could not do very well with a lot of advanced cancer patients if they had already had chemotherapy. And so his policy was, it wasn't 100% because I knew other people he did take who had chemotherapy, but he tried to get people without chemotherapy because chemotherapy destroys the liver. So he said, I fight cancer by rehabilitating the liver, detoxifying the liver. Because remember, the liver is your septic system in the body. It does two things simultaneously. It detoxifies everything bad that you put in, but then it conjugates and reassembles nutrients so your body can actually use them in the way that the body needs. So rebuilding the liver was crucial. Now, there's two primary nutrients to do that. One is glutathione, and that's why I always suggest for anyone with any life-challenging illness, make sure you're getting your glutathione. Well, glutathione is very poorly absorbed. Now, if you take alpha-lipoic acid and glutamine and grapeseed extract and pycnogenol, you can create glutathione. Or, better still, you get your holistic practitioner, either a nurse practitioner or physician, to inject you with a, let's say, 5 cc's of glutathione. Really helps. And the other one is alpha-lipoic acid. So here you have a nutrient that has been shown, even in late-stage liver and pancreatic cancers that were metastasizing, it has been shown to make an enormous difference. So please add this as part of your overall therapies to help you, especially if you have problems with your liver, if you had sclerosis of the liver, if you have hepatitis of the liver, you really need. I would say, well, it depends upon the person, but I would say 600 to 1,000 milligrams of R-alpha-lipoic acid in divided doses, like 300, 300, 300, something like that. I hear all the time from people about how they're doing using different protocols. And I've heard a lot of good about coconut oil. One is that coconut oil is good for diabetics. We know that. We also know coconut oil is good for turning off inflammation in the brain. So people with memory loss, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, dementia, ALS, multiple sclerosis, all benefit from raw organic coconut oil. And it also, we now know, coconut oil lowers blood sugars. And all that's good. So anytime that you've seen in your own life some real benefit to a therapy that, and you can't say it was only because of one thing, but you knew that by taking it, you felt a lot better, let me know. I always like to share that. From Washington University School of Medicine, in obese patients, a 5% weight loss, that's not a lot, that's 5%, has significant health benefits. Now, we're a morbidly obese nation, both adults and children. And researchers have found that even small weight loss markedly lowers a patient's risk of diabetes and cardiovascular disease, and it improves metabolic function in the liver, the fat, and the muscles. This was published in the current issue of Cell Metabolism. Quote, our findings demonstrate that you get the biggest bang for your buck with 5% weight loss. Well, I would disagree with that. I believe that's a good beginning. But when you consider most overweight people don't lose weight, they just continue to gain, 5% in effect is starting the reversal process. And that's good. And also, according to the American Chemical Society, published in the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry, salt can really damage your liver. Now, we don't think about how many products have salt in it. When you eat the, let's say, the fried chicken, you've got salt in there. The hamburger, salt. Salt's in so many dishes. And then we add more to it. Well, we know for sure that that can lead to high blood pressure, a potentially dangerous condition if left untreated. And our bodies need salt but just small amounts. In fact, the U.S. government recommends 1 teaspoon per day if you're a healthy adult. We need about 800 milligrams. We're getting about 5,000 milligrams. So we're getting over 500% more than what our body needs. That's not good. That can lead to damage to the liver, according to this latest study, in addition to high blood pressure. So what if you like the taste of salt? There's two simple things you can do, and it can make an enormous difference. Simply take lemon and lime, apple cider vinegar, equal amounts of each, I would say maybe an ounce. You stir the three together. You put it into a mister, one of those little bottles that you would mist your plants with. And then you mist that on your salad. You can mist that on a baked potato. You can mist it over brown rice, or you can mist that over vegetables. You would think you had salt, but there's no sodium. There's only good malic acid and other terrific limonene, essential polyphenols, all good for you. And finally, a good study published in the journal Cancer Prevention Research shows that when you're taking your omega-3 fatty acids, now you can take them from vegan sources or you can take them from fish. They both work, but they're showing here they can help women who are overweight reduce the breast density, which is a biomarker for the development of breast cancer. Quote, the higher the breast density, the more likely the woman will develop breast cancer. Well, if you're able to reduce the density of the breast and omega-3 reduces the density of the breast, then omega-3 reduces the risk of breast cancer. And that's what we want. Finally, I did mention from the University of Virginia, people who feel that their financial outlook is shaky may actually experience more physical pain than those who feel financially secure. That's according to research in Psychological Science, a journal of the Association of Psychological Science. And the findings indicate the link may be driven, at least in part, by a feeling of lack of control over one's life. Quote from the study, overall, our findings reveal that it physically hurts to be economically insecure. Results from 6 separate studies establish that economic insecurity produces physical pain, reduces pain tolerance, and predicts the over-the-counter painkiller consumption. So what are my thoughts on this? It's straightforward. We're all right now having different challenges in our lives. And we're happy on those days when everything is harmonizing, when we're not out of control of the issues in our lives. We have someone that cares for us. We have friends. We're happy with our work. We find that we're living a legacy of decency, of honor, or morality. And we just feel imbalance with life. We wake up. We give thank you for being alive another day. And to show the grace of that, we share what we can with others. And that's what happens. And then you just feel so much better. In point of fact, your DNA is actually turned on to healing. Your brain begins to create more ideas. You begin to see solutions where before you saw problems and the consequence of the problem. And now reverse that. You wake up lonely. You wake up going to work that is highly repetitive, but it pays your bills. You may not like where you're living, but feel you have no choice. You're stuck with the circumstances, and you can't control the circumstances for some reason or many reasons to that moment. What happens then is the body's DNA turns epigenetically into the off position, and we begin to feel helpless. Now, here's one of the psychological dramas of our past. If at any time when we were growing up, we saw people in pain, they were comforted. And so what we're really doing is we're putting out the idea that we're in pain, because with pain comes, more often than not when we're young, a mother's comfort, that everything's going to be all right, that no matter what happens, you're still loved, you're still treasured, it's okay. So even though we're consciously, intellectually, not aware of this, That's one of the reasons, not the only reason by any means, but one of the reasons that when we're stressed, we find ourselves disabled, being lethargic, depressed, in pain, frequently some combination, with the hope that there'll be someone who will help us, who will protect us, who will love us. Because right now in this moment, it doesn't feel like it's going to be a good day. So, the power of our conditioned genes from everything in our past will turn on or off the pain-free or pain, happy or depressed, trauma or exuberance, feeling good or feeling tension in any given day based upon the circumstances that we're faced with that day. What this study is showing is that when people feel insecure financially, because then you start thinking of all the things you're likely to lose. And in today's world, you see it. You see millions of people's homes foreclosed on, families out. You see student debt and the stress of not being able to find a job to pay those back in a timely manner, being a debt slave. You see SWAT teams and U.S. Marshals arresting people for delinquent college loans. Yeah, very common. And you feel helpless. You feel overwhelmed by the circumstances. All the more reason to gain some insight through mindful meditation that no matter how bad the circumstances are, you can still feel good about yourself. I'm Gary Noll. More on that on an upcoming program where I'm going to have a person who's going to show us how to deal with all the crisis in our lives. We're going to take a brief break and we're going to come back. Please stay with us. People talking, but they just don't know what's in my heart and why I love you so. I love you, baby, like a man I love gold. Come on, baby, let the good times roll. Let the good times roll. Come on and soothe my soul. Let the good times roll. I'd like to welcome you from all over the world. I'm Gary Noll. Coming up in the next 4 weeks, three new feature films done, 100% in the can. Two major books finished, out. Now, these are pre-publication and pre-release, but this is what I've been working on, and wrapping a lot of stuff up. So I'm very pleased about where we stand, and we've got a lot of empowering information for you that will help with a lot of you who are engaged in different social causes and issues. Also, want to mention that you've been watching, I'm sure, or listening to at some level, all of the chatter about who's going to win the nomination for Democrat or Republican, and much of this is just pure nonsense and theater. If we really cared about being a republic, remember, we're a republic, not a democracy, but imploring democratic principles, then we would have multiple parties all having an opportunity to share a forum and their ideas from which we could decide if there were any that made sense. We don't have that. We have two parties that represent the same corporate interest, the same ideological interest. It doesn't matter if you took Bernie Sanders and you asked him, why would you support the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia? Because they support beheadings, and they just sentenced one guy who didn't believe in God to 2,000 lashes and 10 years in prison. Well, A, he will never get to prison because at 200 lashes, he's dead. But there they will both behead you, then crucify you. And that's our ally? But that's Bernie's ally. So where I could certainly and do support Bernie on his civil rights and the prison system and stopping it and Social Security protection and universal health care, absolutely support him. Awful lot of things I wouldn't. But all of the candidates have the same identical support for Israel and the tyrants in the Middle East. No, they don't. There's one who doesn't, Jill Stein. But you wouldn't know that. The Green Party is nowhere to be seen. So that's why I never tell people who to vote for, but I would hope that tonight at 7 p.m., you listen to the hour I'm going to have with Jill Stein. And Jill is a Harvard Medical graduate, and she's National Board Member for Physicians for Social Responsibility. And I don't throw softballs. I throw blistering hardballs when I'm talking with anyone who is involved in politics. And I'm going to ask her about what exactly she would do. And I don't allow any equivocation. I don't allow pontificating. I don't allow, go right to the point and tell us. If anyone's heard my interviews with these people, they're very frustrated because I say it's either yes or no. Do you support universal health care? Yes or no? Well, no, I don't want any walking around the issue. I'm going to be nailing a lot of issues. Then you ask, gee whiz, I didn't know this. Unless, of course, you've seen her. She'd be terribly important for a debate with the other candidates. But you're not going to see her here. That's why alternative media is so important. That's at 7 p.m. You can listen to her. Let's say hello to Theodore from Manhattan. Hi, Theodore, your turn.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
The moral issue that you sought to seek an answer of, and the protection issue and the implementation issue, is based on the foundation that they have the moral right to enter the American United States as is. However, there are issues where the existing 11 or 12 million unnationalized non-resident aliens who wish to have green cards exist here in the country already. The issue remains how you have the will to implement the proper conduct of those who are in the Homeland Security, Immigration, and ICE. ICE, who is the task force for giving harsh, draconian, hostile, pretty much a prison sentence for those who are willing to, and able to come to this country and work, Eastern Europeans to Mexicans in South America. And there's also a racial component attached to this and a class component attached to this, where there is special entitlements and privileges for those who are from European countries as opposed to the rest of the world. That is the moral dilemma that needs to be resolved. And the way to resolve this is the proper education and the indoctrination of a program that would educate those who are in the administrators in the bureaucracy who are failing in this process. Number two, the protection issue. Of course, the protection issue is of United Nations. United Nations have also said that those who are in indigenous rights of people to travel, the United Nations Indigenous Peoples of Declaration of Human Rights, and also the United Nations of 1943 or 44 of those of human rights. And those have to be honored and adhere to as protection. As far as implementation, number three, there are vehicles in place to actually have the ability and will to do so. However, once again, our bureaucrats and our administrators are at fault with all of this process, and that needs to be rectified. If they're not able to meet these requirements and criteria, then they should be fired. Once again, most administrators in the United States, most bureaucrats in the United States are brainwashed to not accept those who are immigrants. They are brainwashed to only accept those who are of European Caucasian descent, preferably. And even then, there is a stopgap and hindrance and difficulties even for them to be assimilated into our society. I would also suggest that there is an issue where newly arrived immigrants from all over the world, Southeast Asian, Indian, Pakistan, and other areas of Bangladeshi, perhaps, and South America, have all been brainwashed to marginalize and demean existing people of color in this country, those who are considered African-American descent, and those who are considered Mexican or Puerto Rican. They're brainwashed to be disrespectful and demeaning, and to be degrading towards them because of the white major power struggle here, of white supremacy. That is an issue that you cannot regulate, but is a behavior pattern of brainwashing and propaganda that must stop.
Theodore, I appreciate your input. Thank you very much. And I will continue with those calls on another program, but right now I want to play a short piece about power, because what are we really dealing with in people who exercise power? These, more often than not, are insecure people, frequently sociopathic. Frequently people are hiding their own inefficiencies because they had the power in that moment to regulate and control the outcome of something, and without looking at the consequences. For example, when a Clinton decides that he wants to put an embargo on humanitarian supplies to Iraq, his power exercise caused 500,000 young children to die. Everyone he surrounded himself with harmonized with that negative energy, not a positive energy. And as a result, no one felt any personal responsibility for the death. Think of the people at the banks who were on completely abandoned all moral principles of income equality, helping communities keep factories going, helping to de-ghettoize the American inner urban areas that have been blighted. We had the resources, the money, the will to do that in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, 2000s. We chose not to. Why? Power. Power, you cannot cut power from the pattern and assume the pattern is complete. Power drives sociopathic tendencies, and we would like to believe that it's a sociopath who needs the power, but without power, what does a person have? Take away someone's right to vote. Take away someone's right to say yes or no. Take away someone's right to say no to a vaccine. Take away someone's right to get the education that they need or want, and you've disempowered them. So listen to this short piece. I think you'll find it revealing.
It's about power. These days, most Americans have little or none, not as employees or consumers or even voters. The companies we work for, the corporations and banks we deal with, and the political system we participate in have all been taken over by a relatively small group of very wealthy and privileged people. It's time to take the power back. Now, it didn't used to be this way, and it doesn't have to be this way. It's up to us to build a movement, what Bernie Sanders calls the political revolution, if you will, to make that happen. Consider first the decline of worker power. 50 years ago, a third of private sector workers belonged to unions, which gave them the bargaining power to get a substantial share of the economy's gains. Now, fewer than 7% are unionized, and most of the economy's gains are going to the top. CEOs, who earned 20 times the pay of average workers in the 1960s, are now getting 300 times their pay. Inequality is out of control. We need stronger unions, and workers need a louder voice. Second, along with declining worker power has come growing corporate and financial power. Just over a century ago, Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican, mind you, busted up the Standard Oil Trust and other giant monopolies. 85 years ago, Franklin D. Roosevelt enacted the Glass-Steagall Act that separated investment from commercial banking. Now, due to a combination of deregulation and greed that allowed the financial industry to run amok, a handful of giant banks have a chokehold on the entire economy, and we're heading for another too-big-to-fail financial crisis. We must institute stronger protections for the economy and for all of us, such as resurrecting Glass-Steagall and busting up the biggest banks. Third and finally, big money has taken over our democracy. The moneyed interests have driven down corporate tax rates and expanded income tax loopholes. During the administration of Republican President Dwight D. Eisenhower, the super rich paid a marginal tax rate of over 90%. Now, the highest tax rate is less than half that. And because of countless tax loopholes, most of the wealthy pay far less than 30%, a lower rate than many middle-class families pay. We need higher taxes on the wealthy to do what the nation needs done, like free public higher education. And we must get big money out of politics. The question to be decided as we barrel toward the November presidential election is whether we will continue building the movement necessary to take back the power that is rightfully ours.
And that was Professor Robert Reich, who I have a great deal of respect for, and who's in the current film that's out there called Poverty, Inc. Now, before we go to our guest, Les Leopold, who's standing by, and this ties right in with what we're going to talk about, runaway inequality, this is another part of it. This is a short clip about a Disney World employee who'd been there a long time and who had to train the person coming in on this special visa that I've been mentioning, that millions of Americans who thought they had seniority and protection had no power at all. This is the H-1B worker visa. Listen in, please.
...room with about two dozen highly respected fellow IT workers. The Disney executive made a harsh announcement to us all. All of you in this room will be losing your jobs in the next 90 days. Your jobs have been given over to a foreign workforce. In the meantime, you will be training your replacements until your jobs are 100% transferred over to them, and if you do not cooperate, you will not receive any severance pay. I was completely silent during this meeting, thinking how this was going to affect my coworkers. How was it going to break news to my family and pay all of our expenses? I would soon be living on unemployment. Later that same day, I clearly remember going to the local church pumpkin sale and having to tell the kids I couldn't buy any that year because my job was being turned over to a foreign worker. I started to think what kind of an American I was becoming. Was I going to become part of ruining our country by taking severance pay in exchange for training my foreign replacement? How many other American families would be affected by the same foreign worker that I trained? The first part of my 90-day period was focused on capturing all that we did with our jobs. We all felt extremely humiliated when the foreign worker sat next to us and watched everything that we did. The final period of the 90 days was the most disgraceful and demoralizing, as we had to watch the foreign workers completely take over our jobs. And we came to grips that the upcoming Disney jobs promise didn't exist. Then finally, on January 31st of 2015, we were ordered to turn in our company badges, laptops, and then ushered out the door. How can it be that everybody that hears these stories about Disney and the like, from the barbers to the bankers, are completely shocked? Yet our lawmakers continue to debate the topic and take no action. The reason that more affected IT workers don't come out into the public is twofold. And that is why most lawmakers mostly hear from the tech giants and are very rarely heard from the displaced American workers who will disclose themselves publicly.
And that's one worker. There were 8 million who could join that person. And where did he go to work after that? We have 106 million unemployed Americans. Where is their power? It's easy when someone can fire you if you have no means of challenging it. And that's what's happening everywhere. Les Leopold, nice to have you on today.
So much for having me, Gary.
Les, the growing inequality gap in the United States remains a marginal topic, in my opinion. We're witnessing this right now in the presidential campaigns, where only Sanders and Jill Stein are raising this crisis as a pivotal issue facing Americans, and yet the majority of the nation is siding with candidates who are fundamentally ignoring it, including Hillary Clinton, who only gives referential lip service to inequality. So the majority of Americans, although they feel the brunt of inequality, remain delusional about its causes and those who perpetrate it. But inequality is not simply a matter of a group having more than another. It has much larger consequences in other areas of life that are largely unnoticed and the media doesn't address. For example, a recent Brookings study you have commented on shows that equality parallels the decrease in life expectancy and the quality of health among an increasing segment of the population. And then we don't speak about inequality's relationship to crime and wars, the collapse of the nation's infrastructure, the climate change, and its impact upon the environment. So please address your recent observations that draw a connection between the rising inequality gap with the growing life expectancy gap. We're dying quicker. What impact is this having, especially on minorities and single women and children? And finally, if you have a more inclusive healthcare system, a single payer, which is what I support, for example, similar to other developing nations, how might this reverse these inequality and lifespan trends?
Well, Gary, let me step back and deal with the first part of your comment, which I think is extremely astute, which is why don't the American people perceive the depth and the extent of runaway inequality? And we put this book together, Runaway Inequality, it's called, precisely to deal with that question. And here's the preliminary answer. The American people do not know how bad it is precisely because the media has not addressed it. You know, Robert Reich's numbers that he gave in that piece that you just aired is actually an underestimate. In 1970, the ratio was 45 to 1. One car for the average worker, 45 cars for the top 100 CEOs, an average top 100 CEO. Now it's 844 to 1. If you ask the American people what the ratio is right now, they will say 40 to 1. They're still living in 1970. If you ask them what they think it ought to be, they say it ought to be somewhere like 8 to 1. A strong Democrat will say 5 to 1. A strong Republican will say 12 to 1. It's 844 to 1. And you're exactly right. This notion of runaway inequality pervades all these issues. So now we're seeing it with the lifespan. The top 20% of the people who are in the top 1%, for example, now live 7 years longer than the people in the who are below the poverty line. And this is outrageous that we would actually take 7 years away from the lifespan of people at the bottom of the income ladder. But that's a direct result of runaway inequality. Gary, when we put this book together, there are two takeaways that I want to share with you that come from it. The first one is the problem will not solve itself. This is not just a question of a policy tweak here or there. It is now built into the sinews of the economy. You know, this current recovery, so-called recovery that began in 2008 roughly, 95% of all the new income generated went to the top 1%. And this is during a recovery. The average American has not had a real wage increase after you take into account inflation since 1980. It's really bad. And the second takeaway is, in order to do anything about it, and this is also what you've been talking about, we have to build a very large mass movement to take back our country. And I think one of the best things about the Sanders campaign is that he is telling us the game is not over in November. It won't matter if we elect Bernie and unless we also build the political revolution that he's talking about. And I think if we focus that political revolution on runaway inequality and how it's generated from the sinews of Wall Street's takeover of the economy, we can build something. No one is going to defend Wall Street. Everybody knows they're ripping us off. And in the book, we show precisely how that happens. This runaway inequality is not an accident. It's not just greed. It's greed run wild because of changes in the rules of the system. So we have to fight against that, and we need more people like you on radio, on TV, highlighting the problem of runaway inequality so that people can catch up to where it really is.
That's why I just played that very heart-rendering. Wasn't that hard to listen to?
Yes, and if I could say one thing about that. The reason that is happening, there are very specific reasons why that's happening. There was a rule change in 1982 that allowed corporations to buy back their own shares. This was considered stock manipulation before 1982, and then the Reagan administration changed the rule. What corporations did after that, what CEOs did, a unholy alliance between Wall Street corporate raiders and CEOs began, where they started to strip mine their own corporations, taking every penny they could find to buy back their own shares. In 1980, 2% of corporate profits went to buy back their own shares. By 2006, it was 75%. 75% of every penny earned by a company went to buy back its own shares to boost its price so that the big shareholders and the top CEOs who are getting stock options could cash in. There were almost no such things as stock options in 1980. Now, 95% of a CEO's pay are stock options and stock incentives, and only 5% are salary and bonuses. So that poor young man who is seeing his job destroyed is being destroyed so that corporation, Disney, can get more cash flow to buy back its own shares. You will see in every corporation, they are about stock buybacks, and that is the most pernicious trend that's hit our economy. Of all the things that's happened, that is accelerating financial strip mining. He's going to lose his job so that a few more dollars can go to buy back shares and boost the value of the stock options for the CEO. That's the game. 100% that's the game. Corporation after corporation after corporation. And the net results are all these terrible things that are happening to working people all across the country. And I want to give a warning to Hillary Clinton and her supporters. She had better address runaway inequality, the unfair trade deals. If she's facing Donald Trump, he is going to pound her about these jobs that are being lost and outsourced. She can't defend the sort of neoliberal corporate machine that only needs to be tweaked. She's got to attack it the way you're attacking it, or in the way that poor young man is suffering. She's got to be able to address that head on. If she goes soft on her corporate friends, she's going to have real trouble, and we're all going to have real trouble.
I appreciate that insight just now, Les. At the same time, worker protections and rights have eroded dramatically. Americans work more days, longer hours than any other developed nation.
That's
we
correct.
Are one of the most stressed populations in the world. We have less support for health crisis, and our medical system is in shambles. It is completely based upon disease management rather than disease prevention. And our work environments and demands promote disease, and nobody's talking about this. So what is the solution if people are also forced to succumb to the conditions of labor and labor laws created by an elite oligarchy, which will happen with the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Well, look, you're describing issue after issue that's a direct result of runaway inequality. The only solution is, and I think would be actually feel helpful to people, is to join together in a large populist movement. You know, which needs to start right after the November election. Bernie is field testing the agenda for such a movement. You know, in the 1880s, the populist movement did a spectacular job in putting up a big fight against Wall Street. It brought together small farmers, black and white, around an agenda, an anti-Wall Street agenda. It fielded 6,000 educators across the country. We need about 30,000 educators today. We also need a new structure, some meta-organization, so that we're all linked together, that you and I and all the people that are listening across the country are part of this continuing political revolution. Actually, all the revenues from the sales of this book are going into a national economic education campaign that we've set up with a variety of unions and community organizations, and it's growing. I'm We printed 30,000 copies.
By the way, it's gone. The book is called Runaway Inequality. Just two more questions here.
Sure.
And I'm apologizing for some of the stations because I had to make a short announcement about a BAI, and as a result, it took away some of the time that I was devoting to you, so I'm just going to extend this over a few minutes. I'd like to hear your views on the relationship between inequality and climate change and our environmental catastrophes, and how is climate change and Washington's refusal to seriously address climate change contributing to inequality?
Wow, that's a terrific question. Let me give you one example that I find very indicative of the connections. You know, we bailed out General Motors for good reasons, right? There were 600,000-700,000 jobs at stake there. And I think all of us taxpayers who contributed to that bailout hoped that when GM was on its feet again, it would produce the best environmentally sound car in the world. That was the hope, I think, and treat their workers well. Well, here's what happened. The one of the guys negotiating for the Obama administration, negotiating the deal with the bailout with General Motors, once it was done, he left and went to a hedge fund. The hedge fund then took up a large position, bought a lot of shares of General Motors stock, and then demanded that General Motors take its cash that it had accumulated as it recovered, not to reinvest in new plant and equipment, not to reinvest in a green car, but to buy back its own shares. You know, 3 weeks ago, Gary, they bought back $9 billion of their own shares, therefore boosted the price, and it greatly enriched the hedge fund that took the position. That's how runaway inequality will destroy any efforts to move on climate change. The second part of your question takes us deeper into the sinews of this. You know, when corporations are being hollowed out around the world through this financial strip mining, they're not going to put any money into environmental. They're going to do the bare minimum. They're not going to be innovators because that's wasted money, money that could be used to buy back their own shares. They're not going to put into environmental controls. So when, and then on the converse side, as the climate change problem accelerates, you know it's going to be people at the bottom of the income ladder that are going to suffer the most. It's going to be their livelihoods in New Orleans and along coastlines all over the world. They're going to see their livelihoods wiped out. And then the inequality gap is going to grow even more. We have to put our foot back on the neck of Wall Street the way it was before we deregulated. We have to do that, or this is going to be a lost cause. I think the American people are ready for this movement, and I think people like you can help build it.
Les, thank you very much for being on. Les Leopold, the new book is called Runaway Inequality, An Activist's Guide to Economic Justice, and the website is runawayinequality.org. I agree with that. We are going to have a new national movement where we actually manifest some power in a constructive way. All the best to you, Les. We'll talk again. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more on the next program. Have a nice day, everyone.